The views expressed on the Buckmaster Radio program are not necessarily the views of Bill Buckmaster Communications, LLC, or its sponsors.
Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with John Couch, engineering and producing the show. And together, we welcome you to the Buckmaster Show. It is Tuesday, the 17th of September, 2019. You're on 1030, Tucson's voice for trusted news talk. Of course, we have our worldwide live listening. We have the live stream at buckmastershow.com. And of course, on the mothership, kvoi.com. Podcasts always available for you on your schedule just by visiting buckmastershow.com. Live line number 790-2040. If you would like to join in the conversation at any time during the hour, love to hear from you. Since June of 2015, there have been 19 mass shootings in the United States with nearly 300 deaths, according to the Los Angeles Times. Mass shootings are typically considered to have four or more deaths. Importantly, this does not take into account the number or severity of the injuries. Let's go now to Phoenix and the research director of the nonpartisan nonprofit Grand Canyon Institute, a think tank, if you will. Dave Wells, Dr. Dave Wells, is the research director. The Grand Canyon Institute has been looking at which policy options would possibly reduce gun violence. Dave, how are you?
Hi there, Bill.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Good.
Tell me a little bit about how this came to pass. And we should point out that the Grand Canyon Institute has not been doing original research on this topic of reducing gun violence, but you've been doing a lot of checking with some of these policy options, correct?
That's right. I mean, I think everybody was shocked by what happened on consecutive days in El Paso and Dayton, or within one day, and it really sort of galvanized the idea that, you know, that it's time really again to take a look at it. And so we thought that we'd sort of reach a place where we ought to be circulating, at least for policymakers, because, you know, there's a lot of debate and discussion about gun violence, but there's actually a lot of research out there, even though it's hard to do research on it in the U.S., about which policies are actually most effective.
Why don't we go over some of these? The one you hear a lot about, the policy option banning assault weapons, limits on high capacity clips. What was the bottom line in the research on that one, Dave?
Well, I think the banning the high capacity clips is probably the more effective part of it, because that would cover a wider range of weapons. And that, because we saw with the Dayton shooter that he was active for, was it something like 30 seconds, really short, and he still killed nine people and wounded something like 27. It was that, and so the idea is that this would have the most dramatic effect on mass shootings, not in necessarily eliminating mass shootings, but in terms of how lethal they would be by, if you're able to limit access to assault weapons, but especially get away from the high capacity clips.
Did the 1994 assault weapons ban have some loopholes?
Yeah, it had lots of the assault weapons ban. I mean, it there seemed to be evidence that in terms of the mass shootings that it did lessen that to some degree, but not necessarily the murder rate or anything broader than that. And it, how you defined an assault weapon was really had a lot of loopholes in terms of ways you can get around it. And there's some people who think that if it had stayed in place, it might have had a longer lasting effect. Yeah, so the research is sort of mixed about whether or not the 1994 assault weapons ban had a large impact. But largely, most research these days indicate that at minimum, what it does is it helps lessen the number of deaths in a mass shooting. But mass shootings actually are not the most common kind of gun violence we have.
Research findings on the policy option of universal background checks, permit to purchase.
Yeah, so there are two different kinds of. Right now, we have background checks if you go to a registered gun dealer. But if you get a private sale, it's not you won't be subject to a universal background check. And I think it's our understanding that the El Paso shooter may have got one of these private sales. So the research on background checks does only indicate that would have a positive effect in trying to screen out gun buyers. But the best version of the universal background check is something that states like Connecticut have in place, which is called permit to purchase. And the research has sort of universally found that this might lower gun homicide rates by as much as 40%, and certainly at least about 14 or 15%. And Connecticut's had this in place for over 20 years. And you have to go to your local police department where the background check takes place, and you get a permit in order to purchase a gun. And again, that's been very effective. Obviously, it's not foolproof, because in the case of the Sandy Hook shooting, the shooter got his guns because his mother purchased the gun. So she would have gotten the permit to purchase, and then he was able to access the gun. So it's not perfect, but it has had a dramatic effect. And we've also seen in Missouri where they reversed that. They actually had a permit to purchase in place, and they removed it, and they saw that their gun violence rate, gun homicide rate, went up 25%.
We're speaking with Dave Wells. Dr. Wells is the research director at the nonprofit, nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute, and they've been doing a lot of studying on the policy options to reduce gun violence. One of them that is talked about, one of the options, is prohibiting all violent offenders, including misdemeanors, from owning a gun. Would this have much of an effect?
Yeah, this is another policy area that could have a large effect. So these are violent offenders, again, including misdemeanors, and didn't have to involve a firearm. So we know that, for instance, a lot of the shooters have had domestic violence, and some of the mass shooters had domestic violence in their background. But generally, if you are prone to violence in any form, and then later at some point you get access to a gun, there's a good chance that you, much better chance than the person, people in large, that you might actually commit violence with a gun. So this has been shown to reduce homicide rates by about 15%. So it's one of the more effective things. Federal law says you can't have a gun if you have a felony. It's not very well enforced, so which is why we need to have sort of more better systems of background checks more thoroughly to prevent that. But when you extend it to misdemeanors, it's also even enhances the effectiveness.
Something called shall issue and permitless carry. What is that about?
Well, that's something we have in Arizona. So basically, in Arizona, you don't even need a permit to carry a gun openly. In some places, you have to go through a certain kind of background check and go through safety training in order to have concealed carry. And generally, people who are advocates of firearm rights often will say, this is the good guy with the gun who will stop the bad guy with the gun. There's not any real evidence that that's the case when you look at states that have these in place versus states that don't. In general, the greater likelihood that guns are around, what we see is a slight increase in homicide rates. And the other thing that also can increase is suicide rates. People sometimes don't realize that two-thirds of gun deaths in the country are suicide. So we have about 40,000 deaths annually, a little over 1,000 of those in Arizona from guns, and about two-thirds of those are suicides. And so these kind of policies have been correlated a little bit with slight increases in both suicides as well, in some cases, homicides.
Quickly, Dave Wells, this one's very controversial, the red flag laws.
Yeah, and the red flag laws have, these are cases where people are a danger to themselves or others, and usually due to mental health issues. And people are able to at least temporarily have people have their guns taken away from them through some kind of court process. These have been in place and studied in places like Indiana and Connecticut, and they've been shown to reduce suicide rates by about 10%. So those have been quite impactful. And something that we've sort of uncovered since we put out our thing was it's also true that a number of the mass shooters are also suicidal. And so if we have a policy that's sort of focused in on helping reduce gun-related suicides, it may have a side benefit of actually helping hamper the likelihood of a mass shooting. So these are generally fairly effective, but the idea is that some of these folks are not necessarily clinically mentally ill. They just may simply be suicidal, and so perhaps focusing the mostly this on on suicide prevention might be the best way to approach this.
Let's see if we can work a quick call in. Paul has called us at 790-2040. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, thank you. I'm wondering how you feel about the strict gun laws in Chicago and what they have done, and perhaps they're working in reverse.
Okay. What about Chicago,
Dr. Wells? So Chicago has strict gun laws, and in fact, in McDonald versus Chicago, the Supreme Court overthrew essentially was a ban on handguns in Chicago. The challenge Chicago has is that Chicago is very close to Indiana, and Indiana has very loose gun laws. So there's it's not very effective in terms of preventing guns from coming into Chicago. And that's why national policies are often would be helpful, because a lot of guns in Arizona find their way to California, who has much stricter gun laws. And so that's one of the general challenges, is that if the federal government can raise the bar so that we don't have great differences between areas on gun laws, then that might lessen things and might benefit places like Chicago.
And firearm laws in Arizona, you would say, have minimal regulations?
Yeah, they have minimal, and there've been studies that show a lot of them and find their way into California, where they then get involved in crimes. And again, it's not that everybody who has a gun is involved in crimes, but there's a relatively small portion of gun dealers who are involved in it. And it's hard these days to be very proactive about that, because they don't allow any kind of database where we can really do this. So they'll do checks on guns once they've been involved in a crime. But there's a thing called the Teihard Amendment, which essentially ties the arms of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau from being able to actually create a computerized database, because they didn't want to have a gun registry, to actually track guns more carefully. Because it'd be better to be more proactive about these things, and right now we're not able to do that. So that enables guns to, and again, the small portion of people doing that, it really hampers law enforcement's ability to crack down on that.
All right, Dave Wells, thank you very much. Dr. Wells, Research Director at the Grand Canyon Institute, looking at policy options to reduce gun violence. Thank you, Dave.
I'm glad to join you today. Thank you.
All right. For more information about the Grand Canyon Institute, go to AZGC, AGC, AZ for Arizona, GCI.org. There you go. This portion of the Buckmaster Show presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. John, pull up the temperature if you can in Silver City, which is only a three-hour drive from Tucson. 77 degrees and sunny at 1 o'clock, because they are on a different time. They're on mountain time, so they're an hour ahead. That's pretty darn nice. Upper 70s, mile high elevation of about 5,500 feet. Can't beat it this time of year. What a beautiful time of year to visit Southwest New Mexico. Go to their website, southwestnewmexico.org. They'll find the listing of the great places to stay and so many recreation opportunities in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. Shelley Fishman is next. Shelley's giving me the thumb going sideways, which means the market is basically flat. But Shelley has some very interesting things to talk about, including the surprising cost of climate change to the United States and some other countries, too. We'll be right back. I've got lots to consult with Shelley Fishman about today. Shelley, how are you?
Hey, Bill. Doing well.
The Fed is meeting for a couple of days, and they're talking about interest rates, and the president was talking late last week about Japan and I guess some European countries looking at what they call zero interest rate.
Or less,
negative interest rate. What's the benefit to that?
Well, theoretically, the benefit would be that if the banks can lend money to each other overnight and actually get a profit from borrowing money, that it's like printing money. What happens is there's theoretically more money in the general economy, and that's considered to be stimulative.
But consumers would still pay a fee.
Consumers would normally still pay a fee.
Because that's how the banks are going to make money.
Exactly. And what's important to understand, again, and we've talked about this before, is there's so much cash in the system right now that it's not clear that making cash more available or at a cheaper price is going to have any stimulative effect in our economy. Now, in Europe, it's a somewhat different story, but here in the U.S., the general wisdom from the pundits about the Open Market Committee meeting today and tomorrow is that they'll knuckle under to from pressure from the administration and probably will cut the short-term interest rate by about a quarter of a point.
I want to talk a little bit about cost of climate change. You've been doing some research, and these numbers are really astounding. Anyone that doesn't think climate change is costing us big time really hasn't, I guess, looked at the numbers and like you have.
Right. So climate change is one of the essential, the most fundamental drivers of market and economic performance over the next decade. So it's one of the, two or three things that you and I have talked about as being, critical to economic success or failure. And I'm going to, full disclosure, I've stolen these numbers from Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this past Sunday.
Okay.
He just reviewed them, and they were so interesting that I just couldn't kind of pass it up. He took a look at the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, and then the decades since 2010. The number of named storms in the 1980s, all of the 1980s, that decade was 93.
Mm-hmm.
Since 2010, and we're not done with the hurricane system yet, we've had 149.
Wow.
So, that's just an incredible change, and it's been gradual up in each decade. The number of weather events that have been costing $1 billion or more in repair afterwards was 28 in the 1980s. That's the total for the decade. Mm-hmm. We are already at 111 since 2010.
Boy, and the cost.
The cost, okay, great question.
Yeah.
The cost of these disastrous storms and weather events in the 1980s was $172 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's adjusted for inflation, so that's in today's dollars. The cost of just since 2010, what would you guess? Is just in the nine and a half years.
Pushing $1 trillion.
Very close, $761 billion. Now that's very close to our entire deficit
right.
for the year.
Yeah.
It's very close to our military budget.
Mm-hmm.
That's the economic effect climate change is having.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, and it's tragic, in the 1980s, there were 2,800 fatalities that were attributed to weather events.
Mm-hmm.
And since 2010, not counting Dorian, because we don't know what that number is, we've already had 5,200.
Wow.
So, it's whether it's man-made or not, you can have this conversation.
Pretty
much
everybody now is on the same page when it comes to the fact that there is climate change.
Right.
There will be disagreement over what is causing the climate change, but I think everybody can agree the climate is changing.
And that seems to be the direction that opinion is going in. So what we know is that there is going to be an economic cost. These were just figures for the United States, by the way.
I was just going to ask you that about the death toll. That's
just the U.S.
I would be curious if the number for worldwide would be
several times.
Several times that.
But the critical issue here, Bill, is when you have events that are causing that much economic. Essentially waste,
yes.
Because you have to then go fix what wasn't broken.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to have a huge effect on your ability to take care of infrastructure, your ability to take care of medical problems and medical care, your ability to even pay back the debt that you have in the country. So it takes your choices away from you. Now, we talk about carbon taxes and the things you can do to mitigate the human causes of climate change. But what we see is whether you spend that money up front or spend it kind of as it happens, you can't avoid spending it. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that our policymakers really need to take into account, because now there's no way out. You can argue whether or not mitigation of greenhouse gases is going to have an effect of mitigating the effect of climate change, but the question is, what happens if you don't do it? Mm-hmm. This just gets worse and worse and worse until these costs become conservative a decade or two from now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, you can say, well, it's a decade or two from now. I'm not going to be here. I don't have to worry about it. But, you know, the fact is you do. The way of mitigating some of these, we saw two islands in the Atlantic essentially inundated just this past month.
Yes.
And we've talked about that happening off the coast of Africa. We've talked about it happening, kind of far away.
Right.
But it's not far away.
No.
I mean, it's in New Jersey. It's
Grand Bahama and Abaco Islands in the Bahamas, which are granted not the entire Bahamas, because the archipelago is 700 islands. And we're going to talk in a few minutes with Ryan Hansen of Bon Voyage Travel how some of the major islands were not impacted at all. But Grand Bahama and Abaco were definitely hit so hard that Abaco is just like was flattened.
Right. And so when you have essentially a flat piece of land that doesn't have anything more than about a 20-foot rise across the entire island and a storm surge of 30 feet, guess what happens?
Yeah.
And, you know, put together with the storm lingering for 24 hours and having 200-mile-an-hour winds.
Yeah.
But that's the thing that we're dealing with more and more. The number of critical events is rising and the cost of the economy. And eventually, Bill, that cost is going to come out of our growth. It's going to come out of our ability to keep this economy going. And it's not just here. It's across the world. The scope of the disaster, potentially, I think, just really needs to be looked at in a dispassionate way.
All right, Shelley Fishman, Certified Financial Planner. You can find out more about Shelley at buckmastershow.com. Thanks, Shelley. I hope you have a great week.
You too, Bill.
All right, Ryan Hansen, we talk travel right after the break. CBS News right now. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. It's time for Insider Travel Talk. We're going to talk travel on Buckmaster with our travel contributor. I am so delighted. I'm just blessed to have 24 or so contributors who are experts in their fields, who are regulars on this program, and I get the best of all their expertise. Ryan Hansen is our travel guy. He's the president and chief operating officer of Bon Voyage Travel, serving travelers for more than 40 years here in Southern Arizona. There's at least, I'm not sure, Ryan, what your latest count is, but I always say it's about 75 Bon Voyage travel. Am I close to the
number? You are right. You're right on the mark.
75 travel experts. These are people who are standing by right now. They want to create your trip of a lifetime. In fact, they'd be honored to do so. There are three Southern Arizona Bon Voyage offices, River and Campbell, Green Valley and Oro Valley, and bvtravel.com. Such a great website that Ryan and his team put together. It's the first stop in making your travel dreams come true. Rhino, how was the summer? You had a great summer. You were doing some traveling with the family and some traveling for business. Just last week, there was an event, right?
Yeah, I've been all over the place. When you go from the Baltic area, I was in 10 different countries, spanning from Denmark, my homeland, all the way to Sweden and every part in between there. I was in the Grand Caymans, and we'll touch on some Caribbean conversation here in a minute. And then last week, I was in Austin, a little closer to home, but it was a travel industry event where over 250 of the best and brightest minds in travel came together to talk about trends and topics and the best way to provide those exact dreams that you're talking about, these experiences that go beyond just a hotel room or a cruise ship experience. We talked all about how to make it even better in 2020 and beyond.
Well, CBS was there. Peter Greenberg, who does a lot of stuff for CBS, and he chose out of those 250 professionals, one of them was you, Ryan Hansen. What did you and Peter talk about?
We talked about travel trends. We talked about misperceptions of travel agencies and why someone still today, with all the information at their fingertips, would use a travel advisor. And we got and boiled it down to, I won't spoil the interview that will be airing later in the fall. But the real topic was about people always ask about the price of things. They never want to talk about the value and understand what value is. And would you pay more for something that is 10 times better? Of course you would.
Of course you would.
And you do that in your everyday. You, if you want a really good steak, you go to someone that's an expert in how to cook that steak and source that steak. Same thing happens in travel. You want somebody that knows and is an expert and can navigate those crazy waters of the travel world.
Well, you brought up money, and you when you talk about money and travel, you bring up happiness as well. And before we get to the Bahamas, and we'll have an update on that situation in a moment, scientists say that traveling makes us much happier than any material wealth. That is not news to me, and I'm sure it's not news to you, Ryan Hansen, but this was a study, and it's just been released from Cornell University, that you know, the memories that you will have, yes, it's going to cost some money, but the memories are lifetime. And when you go out and buy maybe a big purchase of something, there's a kind of a initial high when you buy something, whether it's a car, that wears off pretty darn quickly.
Yeah, and that's what's great. You and I talk about the beautiful anecdotal things that come with travel, and now we actually have science to back it up.
We do. We got it. I've got it right here. And Cornell University.
Cornell's pretty good. They're pretty esteemed. And talking about that euphoria you get when you make the purchase, there's no doubt that making a big purchase, there is that endorphin release that's exciting. But it does, and that's what the report talks about, it does wane and, in fact, completely go away in some cases. Think of perishable things that you buy that absolutely are gone.
Yeah.
That beautiful steak we talked about, but it's not about the steak. It's
the
not
very
about
expensive
that.
Bottle of wine, right?
Yeah, that's gone in a short time frame. Yeah. It's about the experience. And that was, there's some other studies that have been done, and I loved reading the study. You and I have both pored over it because it touched our hearts, talking about how it brings you closer to the people and the things that you love the most. And those experiences can never be taken from your memory banks. It can never be taken away from you. And that euphoria can be relived again and again and in your mind.
Dorian, of course, did tremendous damage to one of my favorite travel destinations. We did that trip about a year and a half ago in the Bahamas. We were on New Providence, the main island that has NASA. And then we went down to one of the out islands called Cat Island. The misconception, you were talking about misconceptions. The Bahamas are a 700-island archipelago that stretch 400 or so miles from north to south. The Bahamas were not wiped out by Dorian. The hurricane did horrible damage to the island, the northwest quadrant of the Bahamas, namely Abaco Island and the island where Freeport, people have heard of Freeport, Ryan. That's Grand Bahama. There are a lot of beautiful resorts there. Bad damage there.
No doubt.
But other areas, Nassau was not hit, other than some high winds and rain.
Right, and Paradise Island there where Atlantis is, and Harbor Island where the cruise lines all dock and port.
I've seen as many as 7 ships there at NASA.
That's true.
In port. Yeah.
And there are plenty of things to do to facilitate all those passengers. It's interesting. I was listening to Shelley Fleischman that you were on earlier talking about global crises and how it captures the attention. And he's not wrong from a financial standpoint.
Sure.
And we can talk about how the tourism industry is trying to aid in these efforts. But it is the media's role and our role to help identify and educate the misnomers and the things that happen out there. And really the truth is that Bahamas is absolutely a place you can still go to.
Very much open
and most,
for business.
Like you said, the devastation was not in tourist areas. It was either privately owned areas or it was islands that are uninhabitable.
Right.
And when you think about the stretch of that archipelago, it's about the coastline of California. So for you to say, oh, there was a storm in San Diego, I don't want to go to San Francisco, people would look at you and say, what are you talking about? Yeah. Those are so far apart. And that's just, San Francisco's in the middle of California, let alone the upper reaches. So Bahamas are definitely a place you can still go to. They're not down and out.
The Bahamian government just was overwhelmed with all of this. The Bahamas are part of the United Kingdom Commonwealth. So the Royal Marines of the United Kingdom quickly helped, as did the Coast Guard, because you're talking about Grand Bahama being about 100 miles off of the coast of Florida. Very close. They're our neighbors. But you know who else pitched in? The cruise lines.
Yeah, and they're pitching in, as we mentioned earlier, it wasn't to rectify or rebuild the areas that they're going to be porting in.
No.
It's actually the rest of the Bahamian areas that cruise lines such as Disney Cruise Line, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian, all kicked in a minimum of $1 million. In some cases, they were matching gifts that their employees would give up to another $1 million. But those donations were amazing. I was more infatuated and I guess heartwarming by what Royal Caribbean did immediately. You think about the fleet of ships that they had at their disposal. They canceled some cruises for passengers. So instead of just, well, let's leave our ship in port in Miami, they sent the ship to the Bahamas, chock full, stocked full of resources from food to bed linens to any type of supply, non-perishable items to really help with their relief efforts. And within 36 hours, they were able to mobilize their entire kitchens and all of their staff to bring 10,000 meals to the most challenged areas and actually took some of the Bahamian residents off the islands that had no place to live. They had, think about the cruise ship, how many beds. Some of these had up to 6,000 beds.
Yeah, they were housing people on the cruise ships. So, I mean, the kudos to them for really to stepping up. And again, I wish the media would do a better job. And maybe it's the fact that Americans sometimes aren't the best when it comes to geography, and we don't understand really some of these areas, how large a region we're talking about with the Bahamas. But in fact, the Bahamian Tourism Group is trying to get people to rethink about Nassau. There are all sorts of buys available right now the Bahamas. And you're helping really recover the Bahamian nation by putting some dollars out there.
That's right. In so many of the Caribbean ports, it's been Puerto Rico a couple years ago with Irma. The number one source of revenue for these countries is tourism. So going to these areas, while maybe you think, gosh, I'm going to enjoy a beautiful island while there's other people on this island or others in the chain that are stressed and distressed, you're actually helping by spending your tourism dollars there versus going somewhere else to revitalize this beautiful area for generations to come to be able to experience what you and I keep going back to is the true happiness, is those experience, shared experiences with friends and family.
Well, quickly, last May, as part of our trip in the West Indies, we were on St. Martin for a couple of days, and you mentioned Irma, and Irma had smashed into St. Martin before it hit Puerto Rico with up to 200 mile an hour winds, and it was just devastating. But the people, just to see what they're doing and how they're rebuilding, it really gave you a good feeling that you were spending your tourism dollars in an area that was going to help people.
Yep, and that brings happiness as well, as being a part of something bigger than yourself. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to illuminate what the cruise lines are doing, because that part of the media story of this crisis in the Caribbean needs more light, needs more illumination for others to see. the world is a better place, even though we have these challenges.
All right, Ryan Hansen, always a pleasure. People can find out more at bvtravel.com. The next time we talk with you will be right before your cruise with my buddy, Matt Russell.
That's right.
That's going to be great. Are there still some opportunities available on that?
Last minute. It would probably be very challenging after about this week or so to get to that Greek and Italian dreams. And it is going to be food and beverage deluxe. And you know that with Matt Russell.
I know he wouldn't
do it any other way.
I've got several friends, actually, who are going to be on board that trip, including my CPA, Michael C. Flowers, is booked for the trip with some friends. That is going to be a fun trip. And we will see you, Ryan Hansen, in October, right before you take off for the Mediterranean. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Buckmaster, on a Tuesday on 10:30, The Voice. Be right back. Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show on this Tuesday, the 17th of September. Have you been over to Green Thing since Zocalo joined their family at 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park? We all know that Green Things is the go-to place for all of your gardening needs on their 13-acre site, but boy, do you have a treat when you check out Zocalo Village. 5 shops devoted to great merchandise. Much of it's handmade. Some of the beautiful hand-carved furniture from Mexico, Latin America, and Europe. Check it out. GreenThingsAZ.com, a good starting place for Green Things and Zocalo, a marriage made in heaven. Almost the end now of the ozone season here in southern Arizona. What does that mean? How is it gone? Let's check in on the Buckmaster Show live line with Beth Gorman. Beth is the Senior Program Manager for the Pima County Department of Environmental Quality and the most knowledgeable person I know when it comes to Pima County air quality. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Doing well. I don't want to jinx things, but hadn't it been pretty good this ozone season?
Yes. The season usually runs from about April through September, so we're not quite at the end of it, but things are looking really, really good, especially compared to last summer. You might remember, I think we talked about it on one of your shows, last summer for the very first time, we exceeded the EPA health standard for ground level ozone 5 times. And that's something that you don't want to do. Normally we want to exceed things and do well, but in this case, you definitely don't want to go over that standard because that means that people that have respiratory disease are having trouble breathing. And so last year was kind of bad and it caused us to violate that EPA health standard. But this year, we're doing way better. We've only had one exceedance.
That was the first time ever happened in Pima County where we did violate that EPA standard. Was that an anomaly, or what was the reason last?
It's a tricky pollutant, and we know that Phoenix also had high levels last year. And it's a combination of the emissions, the pollution that we put into the air, and then also how the weather condition is. Because for this particular pollutant, it's a photochemical reaction that occurs. So you put the emissions in the air, but then the sunlight bakes it and causes this chemical reaction to occur. So if you have the right weather conditions, you'll have high levels of ozone as long as you have those emissions in the air. So we don't know exactly why this year has been better, but it's also been better in the Phoenix area too. So I tend to think it could be weather related, that it was a little bit better this year. But also we're hoping that the education that we did at the beginning of the season, people heeded that and they drove a little bit less. Maybe they didn't idle their cars quite as much. Maybe they tried to skip trips, share rides, and not put as much pollution in the air. And that's what we're hoping.
Before we leave the ozone topic, so this is going to turn out to be a pretty good ozone season. Give us a couple of more tips. You mentioned about engines idling. Give me some more.
Well, we can try to reduce these emissions by, like when we fill up our gas tank, those gasoline fumes that come up when you stick the nozzle into the end of the car to pump the gas, those fumes are something called volatile organic compounds, and they are part of that combination of things that cause ozone. So if we could try to refuel late in the day when the sun is down low, then it won't be able to react with those emissions, the gas fumes. If we can use electric lawn and garden equipment as opposed to gas-powered equipment, that'll help. If we keep our tires properly inflated, you won't have the drag on the road, and so you won't be using a lot of gasoline, so you'll have less emissions coming out of your tailpipe. So a lot of different things like that that we can do that will help the air.
You mentioned lawn equipment. Isn't there a program starting in November concerning this, residential lawn equipment owners?
It is. It's really exciting. We've been talking about this for a little while, but we finally got some funding from Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. We're very grateful for this. We're going to be starting a program, we think, in November, and we're going to be collecting the old gas-powered lawnmowers, also things like weed whackers, string trimmers, hedge trimmers, any kind of landscaping equipment that is used gasoline. We're going to try to encourage people to help the air by switching to electric or battery-operated equipment. And what they can do is they can go online and fill out an application form, and then if it's accepted, then they can take it to a drop-off center, and we will dismantle it and, you know, basically crack the crankcase of it so it can never be used again. And then we'll give them a voucher towards the purchase of cleaner electric or battery-operated equipment.
Before we let you go, Cyclovia is coming up. That's the air quality event.
Yeah, we're really excited about this. This is put on by Living Streets Alliance. It's a fun opportunity to be out in the streets, not driving your car, and maybe practicing how to ride your bike. It's a fun event. It's on October 27th, and basically to get people to get to know different parts of the community. This route's going to be along 12th Avenue, and there's going to be mariachi music and folklorical dancers and all kinds of fun things. And we'll have our booth there. So come visit us, and hopefully you can play some of the games that we have and learn something about the environment and things that you can do to help air quality so we've got healthy air to breathe.
Again, that is Sunday, October 27th, 9 to 3 in the afternoon. And Beth, give us the location again, please.
Well, this route's going to be along 12th Avenue from about 44th Street down to Mission Manor along Drexel area. And you can go on the cyclovia.tucson.org website to get all the details.
How many years have they had this Cyclovia?
I think 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have two events a year, one in the fall, one in the spring, and then sometimes they just have the one. But it's so much fun. If you've never gone, I mean, literally the last event, they said 40,000 people came. And so there's no traffic, no car traffic. People are out there. Little ones are riding their little two-wheelers or their tricycles, and people are out there walking and dancing, and there's so many smiles that I see on people's faces. This is my favorite event that we do.
Where can you find out more?
Well, you can go to Living Streets Alliance on their website, or you can go to Cyclovia Tucson, which is cyclovia.tucson.org.
Okay, Beth Gorman, always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Beth.
Thank you, Bill.
Bye-bye. Beth Gorman is the Senior Program Manager for the Pima County Department of Environmental Quality, and pretty good news about the EPA ozone standards. I think Beth said that we have only exceeded the level once this year, and that comparing to last year when we exceeded 5 times. So I don't know what was going on last year, but things are better this year, so that's good. That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show. I want to say thanks to John Couch. Thanks, John, for engineering and producing the Buckmaster Show today. Thanks to all of our guests. Tomorrow we have Victoria Mazes. It's always fun to talk with her. She is our health contributor on the Buckmaster Show. And we'll have Pima County Supervisor Sharon Bronson. Today was the vote. I don't know how it came out. In fact, the meeting may be still going on about raising the tobacco age in Pima County from 18 to 21. We'll talk about that and more on Buckmaster tomorrow. Meantime, have a great afternoon and evening.